With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Rebounding harvest tests agricultural trucking companies. Trucking companies that haul crops from fields and orchards to processing facilities and transport packaged produce to ports and retailers have been especially busy over the past couple of weeks. After 3 years of drought gave way to heavy rains, tomatoes, almonds, pistachios, and wine grapes were expected to outpace last year's production. That's according to estimates from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Tom Barcelos, a Tulare County farmer who runs a trucking business, said his fleet of trucks has been stretched thin by the San Joaquin Valley record-setting pistachio harvest. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Vilsack announces $2.3 billion in CCC export spending as a likelihood of a farm bill extension grows. USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack says he's stepping in to fill the export promotion void left without a new farm bill.
Each day that goes by without a speaker, without a budget, and without a farm bill, the likelihood of an extension grows.
And while the new speaker was voted in, Secretary Vilsack did make the announcement to use that $2.3 billion in CCC funds for export promotion and international food aid.
The decision that we're making and the decision that we were asked to make by Senators Bozeman and Stabenow is designed to provide some additional boost to trade at a time when it is challenging for the drafters of the Farm Bill to provide the resources necessary to meet all of the demand.
Vilsack says that justifies the need to use all funding tools available. $1.3 billion of CCC money will go toward regional agricultural promotion programs to promote specialty crop exports and to continue a program started during the China trade war. $1 billion will buy U.S. surplus goods to combat global hunger made worse by foreign conflicts.
The unprovoked war in Ukraine, the current conflict in the Middle East, the stresses and challenges being faced by African nations, some Asian nations, and even Central America and South America.
Close to 1 billion people face chronic hunger or starvation. Meantime, the fiscal year 2023 U.S. farm trade deficit was at $19 billion and is forecasted to grow to $27.5 billion this fiscal year. An AFP contributed to that report, and now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
CDFA has confirmed the presence of a new beetle pest in tree nuts. Cooperative Extension Specialist Houston Wilson said that while it's a new issue for California growers, Australia has been dealing with it for several years.
The species is Carpophilus truncatus, and this is certainly one that we've been aware of because of the publications and the research that Australians have been generating over the past 5 or more years. So farm advisor Phoebe Gordon reached out to me about 6 weeks ago with a sort of strange farm call from a PCA reporting that something was boring into the nut. And, you know, as soon as he shared pictures with us, it was pretty immediate, like, wow, that looks just like this thing from Australia. And so we started inspecting nuts and sure enough found some pretty characteristic signs of damage. There's frass that they produce that is very fine, almost like a powder. And the larvae of this beetle bore into the nut and leave sort of an oblong shaped hole in the nut. And so, you know, as soon as I saw that in the field, we started collecting a bunch of the beetles that were there and sent those off to the California Department of Food and Agriculture for their official pest diagnosis. And sure enough, it came up as Carpophilus truncatus, which is the species that's known from Australia to directly attack almonds.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, we have a new Speaker of the House, and he's somebody already trusted by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. I spoke with NCBA's Vice President of Government Affairs, Ethan Lane, to get more information.
Well, so we have a longstanding relationship with Speaker Johnson. We've been supporters of Congressman Johnson for all of his time in the House of Representatives. Going back to before my time running this office, he's a very principled conservative. And when I say that, I mean sort of the older, definition of that rather than sort of the newer populist meaning of conservative. He's very resolute in his view of those principles. He is for free markets. He is for individual liberty. He is for limited government. And those tend to be values that overlap very strongly with most cattle producers around the country and certainly with NCBA's policy book. And because of that, we've been long supporters of Mr. Johnson's. He is going to bring a fresh perspective, I think, to these conversations. And, I think it's evidenced by the vote that was sort of unexpected, that he was able to get a unanimity of the Republican conference in a time when there were a lot of proclamations that nobody could achieve that he does tick a lot of boxes for both conservatives and moderates in the House Republican Conference. We're hopeful that that's going to lead to a little bit of grace as he takes this role from those camps to allow him to navigate the looming shutdown and the expired farm bill and some of these overseas conflicts that are before the chamber right now. He's going to need all the grace he can get from various camps to navigate those challenges, and he has a very short time frame to do that. We were encouraged to see that within hours of his swearing in yesterday, he was already processing appropriations bills on the House floor. And so it's nice to see them get back to work. And we're hopeful that they can get through that process and start engaging with the Senate to avert a shutdown in November.
Yeah, and he has said that, to expect a pretty busy schedule for them as he tries to get everything caught up that they've, haven't been able to do in the last 3 weeks as they have done this search. As you pointed out, he does fall in line quite a bit with, a lot of things that farmers and ranchers do stand for. I have not been able, I wasn't able to find his voting record on agricultural issues, but what can you tell me that he has stood for agriculture so far?
He has been a pretty reliable supporter of what agriculture has asked for. He's a guy who has voted for the farm bill. He's a guy who has voted for ag appropriations bills. I mean, he's been a supportive member of Congress for agriculture. He hasn't been on the ag committee. He hasn't been involved, in those conversations directly. But he's been a guy who has listened to the ag community and been supportive. And that's not a thing that you can say about everybody in Congress right now. So we're appreciative of that. He listens. He's a thinker. He's a constitutional scholar. He likes detail. He likes to talk about the specifics. And that's something we always appreciate. There's nuance in these topics and you like curious members that want to know the why and the how of these things.
Hear my complete discussion with Ethan Lane in this week's AgNet Weekly podcast. It's available every Saturday through our website, agnetwest.com, and anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, various things do affect lamb prices, and that includes higher cattle prices. With more on that, here's AgNet Media's Will Jordan.
Higher cattle prices will impact pasture and rangeland values, even rental rates. Tony Toso, American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers President, explains.
If you kind of compare it to back in 2014 when we had the really high prices then, yeah, it did affect land values. We're kind of on the cusp right now because cattle prices have really started to increase probably within the last few months to maybe a year. And so seeing the results of that, it lags behind a little bit, but I'd say we're stable to a little bit better. And I think we'll probably see those conditions improve, particularly with the direction we're seeing or the trajectory of the cattle markets right now. So I got a feeling there's going to be some optimism and some people looking for opportunities out there. So I would say we'll stay stable and probably see it increase over, I'd say, the next few months to the next year or so.
Toso says there are types of rangelands that are more preferable for ranchers.
Yeah, when you look at the different characteristics of the pasture lands that we have, particularly where I'm at in Central California, the lower elevations are probably more desirable to the producer. They're more open, less trees, less rock. The feed strength is a lot better down in the lower elevations. Now, as you get up higher into the trees and rocks, that type of thing, that's more cow country, and the lower country is more versatile. So that's the most preferred areas that you'd like to be in as far as when you're running cows.
Specific to California, he says spring rains have helped put pasture and rangeland in good condition for the winter grass season.
As compared to last year, the last couple of years with the drought conditions that we've been under, it looks really good. We come back to old feed every year, what we call old feed, turn the cows out on, and we put stocker cattle out on those too. But pasture conditions are much, much better this year than we've seen in the past. Stock water wise, probably even more important. We're really looking good as far as that goes. So compared to the last couple of years, very, very good around here.
Toso says producers are currently working through calving season in California.
Well, we're probably about 75 to 80% done right now. And we were just receiving also some stocker steers the other day. So we're getting ready to turn out those cattle. And the calving season so far is looking great. You know, the better feed conditions that we've had out here, again, like the water, that type of thing, has really helped these mother cows. And our calves look great, especially compared to last year.
As cattle prices move higher, so too will land values. For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
Thanks, Will. And a reminder, USDA did extend the application deadline for the Milk Loss Program, or MLP, but that deadline is coming up Monday, October 30th. The program does compensate dairy producers who dumped or removed milk without compensation from the commercial milk market in 2020, 2021, and 2022 because of qualifying weather events. Eligible causes of loss also include consequences like power outages, impassable roads, and so forth. To learn more, contact your local Farm Service Agency office. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Irrigation in arid California is as complicated as it is essential. Unpredictable supplies, uneven distribution, complicated application schedules, and regulation make it a challenge. No wonder help with water is the biggest request at USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Since 2014, NRCS has invested over $100 million helping over 1,000 California farmers conserve water. By using superior technology and savvy management, farmers get more crops with fewer drops. Join the Water Savings Club. Contact your local NRCS office. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A look at food insecurity in the U.S. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. USDA this week issued its latest edition of its annual Household Food Security in the U.S. report with findings of the amount of food insecurity in our country. USDA economic researcher Matthew Rabbit shares some of the notable findings within the report.
87.2% of U.S. households were food secure throughout the year in 2022. And food secure means that these households had consistent access to adequate food for an active, healthy living for all household members throughout the year. The remaining 12.8% of U.S. households were food insecure in 2022. And food insecure households were unable at some time during the year to provide adequate food in terms of the quantity or quality of food for one or more household members due to a lack of resources. The annual prevalence rate of food insecurity is determined by many factors, including the economy, federal, state, and local policies and the individual circumstances of U.S. households.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. What are some common mistakes that farmers and ranchers and others make when it comes to estate planning? So you're finally going to work on an estate plan. What common mistakes should you watch out for? Let me offer just a few. Make sure title ownership of property complies with your overall estate planning goals and objectives. This includes the proper use of jointly held property as well as IRAs and other documents that have beneficiary designations. Know what the language in a deed means for purposes of passage of the property at death. It's also probably not a good idea to leave everything outright to a surviving spouse when the family wealth is potentially subject to federal estate tax. Fair does not mean equal. In situations where there are both on-farm and off-farm heirs, the control of the family business should pass to the on-farm heirs, and the off-farm heirs should get an income interest that is roughly balanced in value to that of the on-farm heirs' control interest. Leaving the farm to all the kids equally is rarely a good idea in that situation. Don't let tax issues drive the process. Make sure to preserve records and key documents in a secure place where the people that will need to find them know where they are. Also, review the plan periodically. Life events may have changed your goals or objectives. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
Muddy definitions remain for the Clean Water Act. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee held a hearing on the Waters of the U.S. rule. A member of the committee, Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota, says the Supreme Court has a history of leaving the definition of the Waters of the United States vague. He explains that when the Clean Water Act originated, Waters of the United States was based on the term navigable, meaning, for example, a river where one could move a product from state to state, or permanent waters that may cross federal land. However, he says, the definition has shifted to include waters that flow into navigable waters. Still, he says, seasonal waters, such as those created by rain, were not included.
And that's where the definition got cloudy.
He says there's still enough confusion with regulators that those seasonal waters are being included. Read more on our website, agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
A recent visit to Illinois provided Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack opportunity to announce the latest round of funding awards associated with efforts to innovate the nation's fertilizer production industry.
We're announcing 17 grants, $52.6 million of support for projects in 12 states.
The awards are part of the Fertilizer Production Expansion Program, announced over 2 years ago as a response to
amazing pressure farmers were under with the Ukrainian circumstance. We saw a tremendous increase and spike in fertilizer costs, affecting every agricultural production system in the country.
The secretary last year discussing what is known as FPEP. One half of $1 million in initial funding was made available in 2022. And based on high demand for grant awards through this program, through additional Commodity Credit Corporation support,
we are taking $400 million from the CCC and adding it to the $500 million that was announced in 2022 for a total of $900 million.
To date, 33 fertilizer production expansion program projects have been funded over the past year and a half,
totaling $121.5 million in states that are going to produce additional fertilizer, produce substitutes for fertilizer, or to allow farmers to do better use of the fertilizer that they have.
Examples of such projects and what they potentially offer in the way of fertilizer production expansion: dry fertilizer production and storage facilities in the upper Midwest, conversion of manure to fertilizer manufactured into liquid and pellet form at a Wisconsin dairy operation, and expanding an Oregon fertilizer plant to take local organic waste byproducts to create fertilizer pellets. Secretary Vilsack also notes,
we're also announcing four additional projects that we're going to add to a comment period where we're asking folks to comment.
With public comment accepted online through November 15th via www.rd.usda.gov. Click the resource tab on the homepage, then select environmental studies to find the comment portal for these fertilizer production expansion program projects. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
A majority of ag companies are meeting or beating quarterly earnings estimates, while weaker technology stocks continue to pull the NASDAQ lower. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report to end the week, brought to you by Kloss Equipment. Major equipment companies like Kloss depend on the technology sector. They continue to improve data collection, automation, and the technology-heavy NASDAQ on Wednesday had its worst day of trade since February 21st, and it ends the week below major 200-day moving average, first time that's happened since early in March. Meanwhile, grain exporters continue to battle headwinds from the dollar. It ends the week the highest since October the 6th, but they're also battling producers who have increased their storage capacities, and we hear that they're storing a lot more corn and soybeans than was expected. Discover the entire lineup of combines, forage harvesters, tractors, balers, and hay tools from Kloss. Engineered for a better harvest with service you can trust. Visit Kloss.com. This is the Bottom Line Report. Livestock futures continue to move closer to confirming seasonal lows are in, but the path higher looks limited in our view, with cattle and hog futures likely range-bound into the holidays. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
A big storm system this week across the country. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey, what does this mean?
We're mixing some cold air, the Pacific storminess, and then some warm air and tropical air to the south, stirring that all together into quite a cauldron across the continental United States for the remainder of the week.
Such as wind-driven snow across the nation's northwestern tier, perhaps additional snowfall in the northern and southern plains later this week, significant rainfall from a stretch between Texas and the Great Lakes.
But once you get outside the rain and the snow, the other parts of the country expected to see quiet weather over the next 5 to 7 days.
Including colder, drier weather in California and the desert southwest, while what Rippey describes as wide open weather conditions, warmth and dryness, occurs in the southeast and Atlantic seaboard over the course of this week. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Dan Nyberg, sales trainer for Morton Buildings, says begin by preparing for interior work.
Give your heating system a checkup or have it serviced to avoid problems once cold weather sets in. Make sure your lighting is functional and sufficient, and consider LED upgrades. Clean and organize workbench and tools. Look over support equipment such as compressors, welders, drill presses, especially the belts and the wear parts, and inventory your waste oil storage.
Nyberg says after cleaning equipment, the next step is to prioritize the maintenance schedule.
Consider which maintenance project you'll tackle first and when, and make a list. Ensure critical needs are met first to be ready for spring. And remember, projects can take longer than expected. And make your parts list. Finding parts for older equipment could require research or longer shipping time.
He offers a checklist for the most important maintenance work.
Lubricate equipment, coat polish surfaces with rust inhibitor, check hydraulic hoses and replace as needed. Inspect tires. Replace if they're worn or have cracked sidewalls. Make oil and filter changes, including air filters for engines, as well as filters for cabs and operators. And keep technology current with data updates and upgrades.
Finally, Nyberg reminds farmers to make sure basic safety equipment is available and functional, such as exhaust fans, fire extinguishers, safety glasses, hearing protection, and a first aid kit. For more farm shop information, visit MortonBuildings.com. Michael Clements reporting.
night the great pumpkin rises out of the pumpkin patch?
Well, at least in the minds of Linus and the Peanuts gang, that's what happens. Of course, it's that time of year when millions of us are out there looking for our own versions of the great pumpkin for our Halloween jack-o'-lantern. But why do we do this? Why do we carve strange faces in pumpkins, lighting them from inside and placing them at our doorsteps at Halloween? Well, gather around the glowing jack-o'-lantern with Agriculture Department historical expert Anne Eflin for this old Irish story from about the mid-1700s, the story of Jack.
A drinker, a miser, a liar, a good-for-nothing character.
And as we open the story, Jack is being pursued by the devil.
In order to escape, he tricked the devil into climbing a tree. And then when he got the devil up in the tree, he cut a sign of the cross in the tree, and the devil couldn't come down.
Well, that made the devil a little bit mad at Jack, who did eventually let him down out of the tree. But when Jack passed away, he couldn't get into heaven, and the devil threw him out of the other place, tossing him a hot, glowing ember in the process.
And Jack had with him a turnip that he was eating, and he carved out the turnip, put the ember inside, and had a light that was protected from wind and rain and other things while he wanders the earth.
Oh, and wander he did, Jack and his lantern, thus Jack-o'-lantern. Anne Eflin says from that story, the Irish developed the tradition of the jack-o'-lantern. On October 31st, a night when it was believed that Jack and other recently deceased souls wandered the earth looking for live bodies to inhabit, residents would carve out turnips and put candles in them to either help guide the souls along or frighten them away.
When the Irish brought this tradition of the candle and the turnip to the U.S., there were not many turnips around, but we did have these wonderful pumpkins that were even better suited.
Perfectly suited for
Halloween, Halloween, ooh, Halloween.
And another big Halloween tradition. Yes, trick or treat, which Anne Eflin says may come from another ancient Celtic tradition.
Called guising, as in a disguise. Guising, where the poor would dress up in masks and costumes and go door to door, and they would perform in return for food and drink.
Later in Ireland and England, it became Mischief Night, where folks played pranks on each other. The Irish brought that idea to this country in the early 1800s, and by the 1920s, though, Anne says it was getting a little out of hand.
There's a lot of vandalism and crime and some violence. And there was an effort led to change the Mischief Night from having kids out running around causing trouble to having kids going door to door in costume and getting treats in return. It was promoted by the Boy Scouts and other youth organizations of the period.
It started out being called Beggar's Night, but by the 1930s it got the name it has today.
Trick or treat!
Trick or treat, that's right. In Washington, Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. For today's interview segment, AgNet West Brian German was at the CAPCA conference, that's the California Association of Pest Control Advisors conference, earlier this month, and he had an opportunity to talk with our friends over at Bayer. Here's AgNet West, Brian German.
Rick Westcott, a sales representative with Bayer Crop Science.
And we're here at CAPCA this year and talking about, last year was an interesting year in terms of weather and how that affected some things. And so let's kind of go down the list of how that affected growers with some of your products and what to kind of look out for maybe with the rainy season ahead.
So we have a pre-emergent herbicide called Alliant. And with the heavy rains we had last year, it was an issue because a lot of them would wait longer to put it on because they would think that it would last longer on the other end. And when you had all these heavy rains, what ends up happening is you couldn't get into the fields to apply it because it was muddy and it's got to be put on by ground. And so we lost a fair amount of sales because of that. One of the things that I've always said should be done with Alion is it should be put on early, somewhere between the middle of November to about the middle of January is about the latest. And if you do that, hopefully you're not going to get so many heavy rains, because the rains came later last year, right? So if you get the material on earlier, then you don't have to worry about those late rains. You've already got it on, it's incorporated, and it'll be there to work for you into the spring and summer. So that's one suggestion I would have on the Alion situation. Now, the other problem we had with the weather last year was Luna fungicides for the almond market. And what happened there is, with all the rains during the bloom period for almonds, we got a lot of rain and the growers could not get in to spray. Well, Luna has a restriction that it cannot be applied 2 weeks post petal fall. Once you get 2 weeks past petal fall, you can no longer apply it. So we lost a lot of that window before that period came. What's a suggestion? There really isn't anything you can do. I mean, that's a weather-related thing, and if it happens again, it happens again. You can't. There is no other place to put it. So that was kind of an issue. One of our other big products, of course, is Movento, and it's still doing the job like it has been since it was introduced. And one of the big spots for that is vine mealybug in grapes. And it's still working very well. It's kind of the foundation for mealybug control. And the other big thing for Movento is citrus red scale in citrus. And here again, it's one of the foundation products for red scale control. It's usually applied during the thrip timing, and it goes in with the thrip material. And it works very well. It'll also kind of knock the edges off the thrips once it gets circulating into the plant. And that, with this last year, with the thrip pressure that we had, which was probably unprecedented, Movento helped in that. But the biggest problem with the thrip issue was the fact that we have older products. We don't have any new products for thrip control, so it was hard to keep up with them, because the populations were so high and so heavy. There was some pre-bloom type sprays with Savanto, which is another one of our products, that helped reduce the thrips. And some of those places where they did apply it that way, it wasn't as much of an issue, although they still had an issue, but it kind of helped it.
So there's a couple options there of just when you're inundated with thrip populations like that, anything that might be able to, maybe knock an edge off there is going to go quite a ways.
The only thing I can suggest if you think you're going to have a heavy thrip year is start early. Because if you wait until you got a heavy population, you're never going to catch up, especially with the products we have today. So if you can start early, like a pre-bloom spray, even if you don't really see them yet, or maybe you see one or two, that's the time to hit them. And then kind of stay up on it as you monitor the situation. But other than that, there's not a lot you can do.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows, or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Growers are looking at some changing rules for neonicotinoid use in 2024. At the recent CAPCA conference, Riverside County Ag Commissioner Ruben Arroyo highlighted some of the changes on the way and what to be prepared for.
January 1, there'll be mitigation measures that were put in place that were agreed to by industries. But some of the key things here is now that they're going to have to keep track of the material that they're using, which is the neonicotinoid chemistry, that they can only apply so much of active ingredient per season. And if you look in the regulation, it's all stated in there as to if you're using it on citrus, if you're using it on grapes, if you're using it on any crop, it'll be there as far as what you can use. The restrictions are based on the protecting bee portion of this, and it isn't by the label, it's through this regulation that you have to be aware of, are you applying this to a flowering plant? And that's the bottom line here. Some plants flower quite a bit.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
AgSafe gears up for its Cultivate Conference. Next month, business leaders, executives, farmer owner and operators, and farm labor contractors will gather to get a synergistic view of agriculture at the Cultivate 23 Conference. AgSafe President and CEO Teresa Keen shares more.
The Cultivate Conference is a tick different than the other conferences that we have traditionally held. And this really is for executives and management of ag operations, and then also kind of support industries as well. It's a smaller conference, and it's planned that way strategically to ensure that we have great conversations amongst those that are participating, and then also with our speakers. And this year, what we are focusing in on, it's always been about looking at the bigger picture. So what is coming not just in the ag space, but what's happening in this time and place. And so we are talking about looking at our company cultures and how we can support our workforce. So we've got a great speaker, Eric Bailey with Bailey Strategic Innovations Group. He'll be talking about that. We also have an economist that is looking at our labor force in the future. We know that the baby boomers, we don't have the same population that we're going to have moving forward. The next two generations didn't have as many kids. And so as a result, there's going to be a smaller labor pool. So we're all going to be kind of fighting for available labor. So what does that do to us as businesses as we start to plan for our future? How can we do less with more? So maybe thinking about more ways to integrate technology. So we know we're also talking about AI, what's happening in the space, and then also financial forecasts. Where are people putting their money right now? Are we going through a recession? Are we not going through a recession? You know, what do the next 2 to 3 years look like?
The 2023 Salinas Valley Fall Pest Management Meeting is coming up at the beginning of next month. The event will take place at the Agricultural Center Meeting Room in Salinas on Tuesday, December 5th. The program will start at 1 p.m. with a presentation on weed abatement response to the emergence of INSV in the Salinas Valley. Extension vegetable weed specialist Steve Fenimore will also be discussing physical and chemical weed control in lettuce, onion, and spinach. Other presentations include information on Pythium wilt of lettuce and a vegetable IPM research update. After the break, USDA research geneticist Kelly Richardson will be going over lettuce breeding efforts for INSV resistance, followed by other presentations on lettuce fusarium wilt and updates on thrips and INSV. 4 DPR credits have been requested for the event. More information about the meeting is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian. And AFBF congratulates Johnson on the speaker election. American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duval welcomed the election of the Representative Mike Johnson, a Louisiana Republican, to be the Speaker of the House. Johnson was the fourth Republican nominee for the post following the ousting of former Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Duval of AFBF says, quote, "Speaker Johnson has a strong history of supporting America's farmers and ranchers, which has earned him the Friend of the Farm Bureau Award multiple times." Johnson represents Louisiana's 4th Congressional District, encompassing much of the state's western half, and was first elected to Congress in 2016. Johnson calls the election a honor of a lifetime, while proclaiming, quote, "We will restore trust in this body." Duval of Farm Bureau adds, quote, America's families are relying on Speaker Johnson and Congress to focus on pressing needs, including completion of the fiscal year 2024 appropriations and the passage of a farm bill. An AFP contributed to that report. And in more agriculture news, NCBA's 2024 Environmental Stewardship Award nominations are open. Nominations are now open for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association Environmental Stewardship Award. Established in 1991, the Environmental Stewardship Award program annually recognizes outstanding stewardship practices and conservation achievements of cattle producers across the nation. NCBA President Todd Wilkinson says, quote, "This award celebrates the innovative efforts our industry is undertaking to protect the environment, engage with communities, and remain profitable. Any individual, group, or organization is eligible to nominate one individual or business raising or feed cattle. Individuals and families may not nominate themselves, although nominees may be involved in prepping the application. Past nominees are encouraged to resubmit applications, however, previous winners may not reapply. Along with a type application, one nomination letter, and three letters of recommendation highlighting the nominee's leadership in conservation are required, and the deadline is March 8th of 2024. Nominees do not have to be a member of NCBA, but should support the objectives of their state and national organization. If you'd like to find out more information, you can visit environmentalstewardship.org. NAFB contributed to that report. Ragnet West.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.